So without further ado, I would like to welcome up to the stage Professor Gordon Flake.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you, Amy. It is a great pleasure to speak again to the Australian Institute for International Affairs. I had the wonderful opportunity just last week in Melbourne to speak to the Victoria branch on the relatively cheerful topic of North Korea. And so I'm afraid that I can't necessarily keep up that same level of boundless optimism this week. I'm a little bit cowed by the topic this evening, beyond Trump. Many of you may recall that 2.5 years ago, the Perth US Asia Center collaborated with the consulate here to do an election watch party here in this very building, just right next door. What that really means is over the course of 7 or 8 hours during the day, 450 of my closest friends in Perth just watched me melt down. And I was obviously, like many in good company, deadly wrong on my own predictions and assumptions of what was going to happen. And over the course of several weeks, people would meet me on the streets of Perth and say, "Gordon, do you need a hug?" So having said that, I'm really disinclined to kind of tackle directly this notion of beyond Trump, except to say that I'm not really speaking tonight about after Trump or making, at this point, any kind of rash predictions about what's going to happen in November of 2020. We're a long ways out, and again, I'm humbled by that process. But what I thought I might do is, under the broader topic of beyond Trump, focus on some factors that you need to understand the broader implications of the Trump presidency thus far and going into the future. And what I'll do is I'll hit three topics that will kind of set your hair on fire and have you worried, and then I'll end up mercifully with a slight glimmer of optimism to make sure that the dinner is less glum than it might be otherwise. So the three topics I'm going to hit on the more negative side are breadcrumbs, sins of omission, and adults in the room, and you'll understand each of those in turn. And then finally, I'll be talking about the bully pulpit, and that might give you a glimmer of hope. Let's talk about breadcrumbs. One of the characteristics of the 2016 elections that I don't think people focused on nearly enough was how unusual it was. In other words, President Trump as a candidate violated every rule that you assume politicians would follow, right? And you know, even the most simple things about get that baby away from me, I don't want to kiss a baby, get him out of the room, he's making noise. You think politics 101, they do certain things, and you assume certain scandals would overwhelm it. And in fact, that was a core calculus of his 16 Republican opponents. Every single one of them assumed that he would flame out and say something or do something completely outrageous, and then as a result, you know, they would pick up his votes. And so none of them attacked him because they wanted to pick up his voters, you know, that core group that Hillary Clinton infamously called the deplorables. But by the time they realized that he was a real candidate, and despite the fact that he did throw out a scandal every single day, it gummed up the system, it jammed the system. Whereas his opponent at the time, Secretary Clinton, really had one scandal, emails. Everybody knew that. You know, President Trump had a scandal literally every single day, and you couldn't quite process it. And before you could really think about what the implications are, the next day there's another one, the next day there's another one, and it changed the system. So there's a woman named Amy Siskin, a former investment banker in New York, who after the election was so concerned with what she saw in terms of broken standards and norms, not just in the campaign, but in the early days of the transition in the presidency, that she started something called The List. And if any of you are weekly junkies, I don't get any kickback from this, but I would just go to theweeklylist.org. And what she has done is every single week, she has chronicled those actions that are in violation of laws, in violations of longstanding norms, which you just don't do that in a democracy. You know, simple things like the emoluments clause of the Constitution, where you don't benefit from your thing, to real serious things. And she's chronicled them week upon week upon week upon week. And the first year, she had enough to produce this massive volume called The List. And that's ongoing. I think they're probably working on volume 3 right now as they together this list. And the basic premise here is that unless you know where we've come from, you won't be able to get back. That's the breadcrumbs, right? Unless you have some chronicles of things that have been done which have never been done before in American politics, you won't be able to rectify those in a succeeding administration or beyond Trump in that context. Just to give you a couple of senses of what that might be. You may be familiar with what's called the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which basically says you cannot use political office to enrich yourselves. And we saw this again just in the last 2 days with the president proposing that he wants the next G7 meeting with his buddy Vladimir Putin to be at Doral, his golf resort, you know, in Florida. I mean, screaming red flags. Before Trump, you would never have an administration official of any stripe, you know, openly and publicly benefiting financially from their office. And yet there have been, again, literally hundreds and hundreds of cases with the president alone. Those types of things. Other examples, the president, you know, has basically circumvented the Congress. He now has more acting cabinet officials than any president in American history. A complete shattering of norm, because that basically violates the constitutional notion that the Senate has the responsibility to advise and consent and give Senate approval to cabinet positions. But by putting in acting cabinet secretaries, the president doesn't have to submit them to the Senate, and they basically are entirely beholden to him. And again, whether it's the media, there's a whole range of other issues that really kind of hit at the core of the free press, of you know, the nature of the democracy itself that I can't go into in great detail, but are worth looking at in that process. So again, I'd urge you to just look at the list, Amy Siskind, the list, and you'll get a sense, you know, for 2.5 years of that. The second point I'll point out is what I would call sins of omission. We are so focused every single day of Donald Trump's sins of commission, right? Pulling out of the Paris Treaty, you know, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, right? Trying to buy Greenland, you know, saying that the Denmark prime minister is nasty, right? They just dominate the media every single day, things he does. But in the long run, if you start thinking about beyond Trump, I would argue that the sins of omission will probably be far more significant than the sins of commission. Rather than the things he did, it's the things that he hasn't done. And just to give you a couple of examples on this, he has abandoned U.S. leadership on international trade, on multilateralism, on international organizations, on the United Nations. Anything multilateral, anything that requires institutions and standards and norms, the United States had been the leader, in fact, in many cases, the creator. And in this case, they are absent, if not antagonistic, in terms of that process. Another very specific example would be Hong Kong today. You may have seen in the last several weeks the president indicating this is China's business, right? So it's not just Hong Kong, it's human rights more broadly, where the United States, long having been a leader on democracy and human rights, is now absent. I'll give you another very specific example just from the last 2 weeks. You may have all noticed that Korea and Japan, two treaty allies of the United States, are at loggerheads, deeply antagonistic. Japan taking South Korea off their white list, saying basically they can't sell technological materials to Korea because Korea can't be trusted. Korea pulling out of a general sharing of military intelligence agreement with Japan and the United States. I mean, really serious stuff. In a normal world, this would be the United States as a treaty ally, as a superpower, knocking heads together and saying, you guys cut it out. We've got to work together on this. There is no leadership. And you can go on and on and on. As you know well, Australia tends to parrot this notion of a rules-based global order. As a relatively small country, Australia relies, of course, on its own very capable defense capabilities, but primarily on a close alliance relationship with the United States and on the rules-based order, that and international rules-based system. And we're in a situation where, in many cases, our ally, the United States, is the one attacking that system. You know, and this omission of U.S. lack of leadership there is one that's deeply troubling to Australia's views of the room. Third point, adults in the room. At the beginning of the Trump administration, there was a hope, at which I held myself, that the system would hold and that those around the president would control him, right? And we call that the adults in the room. And so whether it was the Secretary of State or the Attorney General, there were a number of people, his chief of staff, that you know were respected in their own rights that we thought, all right, these people will be the adults in the room. They will control this presidency. With the departure of Secretary Mattis, you know, the former Secretary of Defense, I think nobody at this point would use that term to describe any member of this cabinet. In other words, there's not a single member of the cabinet around President Trump who would stand up and contradict him on any issue. Certainly not in public, and by all accounts, not in private either. So there are no checks and balances. And so there is this sentiment that, we suffered through 2.5 years, just ride out another year and a half, and then we'll have a change of government, it would be fine. And look, the economy is doing okay. Another term couldn't be that disastrous, could it? But the thing is, we don't have the same things that we had at the beginning of the administration. All those, one by one, have been eroded away and they're gone. In other words, there are no adults in the room. By my count, after the 2016 election, there were 5 elected Republicans who stood up to President Trump, who didn't vote for him and publicly said so, and it would publicly repudiate his most egregious statements and actions. John McCain from my home state of Arizona, who has since passed on. Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee, who resigned from the Senate, or retired from the Senate, didn't run for re-election. Senator Jeff Flake, who, again, I will say I'm deeply proud of because of what he's done with our family name in terms of holding up to it. He also had made a decision not to run because he couldn't win, is now out of the Senate. Lindsey Graham, who is still in the Senate, but there's a painfully true statement that when John McCain died, we lost 2 senators that day, because Lindsey Graham was tough as long as John McCain was alive, and since then he's rolled over to be President Trump's most ardent supporter. And then John Kasich, who had been a presidential candidate and then governor of Ohio, and at this point is no longer governor. So at this point, there is not a single elected Republican who will speak out in public against this president. And just to help you understand how stunning that is, again, in the last 10 days, the president had declared himself the chosen one, said he was the king of the Jews, that he wanted to buy Greenland, and when the Green Prime Minister, a NATO ally, wouldn't do it, called her nasty, and then went in a public campaign to try to get Vladimir Putin admitted into the G7, continued to gush about how wonderful his relationship was with a murderous dictator in North Korea, Kim Jong-un, because of the nice letters he received, and how wonderful his wife's relationship was with Kim Jong-un, even though they've never met, right? I mean, all these just normal things, and yet there has not been one single Republican to speak up on this. Zero. So that just gets you a sense that there are no longer adults in the room, there are no longer checks. And then more broadly, as I'm running out of time here, there are not just no adults in the room, but it turns out that the U.S.'s much ballyhooed and vaunted and relied upon system of checks and balances were all based on the honor code. They're all based on an ability of an individual to feel shame, to have the capacity for shame. And the good news in this story is that there have not been any successful mini-Trumps in the U.S., right? Because most people feel shame. Most people have caught in a lie repeatedly, won't repeat that lie. Most people have caught in a scandal, will be embarrassed. But in the end, when you have someone who is pathologically incapable of that, the system hasn't figured out quite how to deal with it. So, as promised, let me wrap up with something a little bit more cheerful. The bully pulpit. And it's not this one here. Teddy Roosevelt, former U.S. president, was very fond that the pulpit that the president had was among the most influential tools that he had at his disposal. Rather than constitutional powers, the ability to shape public opinion from the bully pulpit. Now, over time, history has shown that presidents actually have a very difficult time in swaying public opinion. But there was a great piece that came out in The Atlantic just this week, on the 19th, that said that President Trump has been remarkably successful at changing American public opinion on a range of issues of most importance to him in the inverse. So just to give you some specific examples, according to a Reuters poll released this week on race, again, and we've just had 2.5 years of really, really horrific, previously unimaginable race baiting, it turns out that if you ask white males, right, whether or not that they need to protect their white heritage, right, a very sensitive, very racially provocative statement, the number of people that say that's true has gone down 9% in the last year. If you ask white voters across the board whether or not they think that whites are under attack in the United States, that number has gone down 25% in the last 2 years. Stunning, isn't it? It's not exactly the opposite of what you might think. On immigration, over the last year, there has been a 19% increase in support of all Americans supporting a pathway to citizenship of immigrants to the United States, illegal immigrants to the United States. 75% of Americans, a record, an all-time record, say immigration is good for the United States, right? On trade. You know, in 2015, only 51% of Americans said that trade was good for America. In 16, that went up to 55. In 17, it went up to 57. In 2019, that is now 64%. So in all these areas where President Trump is railing his most passionate issues, where we get most concerned, there is a bit of an inverse effect. And I'll end with this. Like all poisons, it's just a question of dosage, right? If you get a really small dosage, it will be, in effect, an inoculation. And the hope is that with a one-term administration, there is a possibility that the American public will wake up and say, we like alliances, we like Denmark, we like Canada, right? We like free trade, we like immigrations, we're a nation of immigrants, right? We are not racially baited, and that there will be room, you know, if there's someone there to take it, right, to have a bit of a rebound. But if not, you know, again, like all poisons, it's a question of dosage. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gordon, and particularly for ending on that positive note. And I guess it has been quite serendipitous that you have been sent across the other side of the world to set up the Perth US Asia Centre here and are a long way away from what's happening there and can commentate on it from afar. And we're very grateful for your analysis tonight. So thank you very much. Righto, I'm going to pass over now to Dr. Sherry Soufi. Now, Dr. Soufi is chairman of the WA Liberal Party here in Western Australia, the Policy Committee, and he is also on the advisory committee to the Federal Party to the Prime Minister. So I feel like Dr. Soufi is going to have some insights from within politics and really looking forward to seeing what he's going to say about Beyond Trump this evening. Thanks, Dr. Soufi.
Well, thank you very much for that very generous introduction, and thank you to the Australian Institute of International Affairs, particularly John Goodlatte, for this opportunity to be with you this evening. In discussing Donald Trump, we have to set some parameters. Donald Trump is probably the most disproportionately discussed human being on Earth, particularly in the last couple of years. And that's fine. Being the president of any country is a pretty big deal, especially being the president of the most powerful country in the world. And that's not just the case today. The United States happens to be the greatest superpower the world has ever seen. So regardless of whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you are going to be in the Oval Office, it comes with great responsibility. Perhaps greater responsibility than being the head of any other country. And when you look at the US presidency from that vantage point, that of itself set certain parameters on how we should view our relationship with a US president. Because we don't come together to discuss the president of, say, Bhutan. Nothing against the Bhutanese, but just as a random example. Why are we here to discuss not only the president of the United States, but a topic called Beyond Trump? In sort of discussing Beyond Trump, we've kind of already conceded that Donald Trump, who was meant to come into office to shake things up, probably already has shaken things up to the point that we're already sitting here debating and discussing what the world beyond Trump is going to look like. So the topic of itself, I think, to an extent concedes that this has been a very different kind of a president. So let's set some parameters, right? It'd be really weird for somebody in Reykjavik, Iceland, to have a really, really strong opinion on Julia Gillard's carbon and mining taxes back in 2011 and 12, if you remember, right? It'd be really weird, unless if that person was directly doing business with Australian companies and was directly affected by it. Sometimes what we tend to do is when we all have the habit of getting involved in discussing politics around the world, particularly international politics, we go into having a bit of a chinwag mode, and anything and everything to do with certain topics gets brought out onto the table. That is not an approach I tend to assume. I want to be much more narrower, and I want to be much more focused. I want to discuss specifically the things which, in my humble opinion, directly concern us. We don't want to be like the random dude in Reykjavik, Iceland, who has a really strong opinion on the carbon tax in Australia in 2011-12. We don't want to be like that dude. whatever it is that Donald Trump is doing and saying to get him elected, to get into power, and to manage power for the American people within America is a matter for the American citizens to decide, and I don't have strong opinions on that. Should they lower taxes? Should they increase taxes? What their immigration policy should be? I have very strong opinions on all of that for my country, which is this one, but not for America. Doing that would be an ideological thing. What we think is good for us is necessarily good for them. I want to avoid that pitfall. So let's really move forwards in this. How an American president interacts with the rest of the world, being the prism through which we're going to have this conversation tonight, is the key. And to understand that, we have to understand why being an American president is different. At the end of World War II, the United States emerged victor. They won World War II comprehensively, okay? And they also won World War I. They didn't want to participate in either of those two wars, but they got there by accident. So America is the accidental superpower. It's not like ancient Rome. It's not like the Abbasid Caliphate in the medieval era that sought to actively conquer lots of land. And today the United States has over 800 military bases around the world. It has landing strips in the middle of oceans and seas most of us in this room probably haven't even heard of. And that is what makes being the president of the United States an immensely challenging task. You're not just governing the 300 or so million people in your own country, but you're essentially governing the 7 billion people on this planet. You don't want there to be another Stalin. You don't want there to be another Hitler. You don't want there to be any other kind of dictator or extremist of the kind that all human history is filled with. All human history is filled with some terrible, terrible leaders. Some terrible leaders from the ancient to the very modern. That is the job of the leader of the free world. So here's how we set the parameters. In fact, let me tell you here how we don't set the parameters. We should not be debating whether Donald Trump has been a great president so far or whether he has been this terrible misogynist racist that the media has often made him out to be. These are extreme prisms through which to judge this very fragile position. Okay? We want to be asking ourselves, has he left the world better off or worse off than his predecessors? That is the prism through which we should be looking at Donald Trump, from the point of view of his interaction with the broader world. So let me share a couple of points on that. We're all aware of the scourge of global jihadism. To a large extent, this all kicked off about 30 years ago with a war between Osama bin Laden, who issued two fatwas during the 90s, and the Americans for blaming him for intervening in Middle Eastern affairs in trying to drive the invading Saddam Hussein military out of Kuwait. He said, this is an internal matter. Iraq invades Kuwait. That's an internal matter for the Muslim world. Who are you to be intervening in our affairs? At the time the Gulf War happened and so on and so forth, it was supported by the leaders of the Islamic world, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, so on and so forth, but that didn't go down very well with the public. They bought the bin Laden narrative, that America is this great Satan. Now, Donald Trump realizes this. So what's he done? Yes, he used very harsh rhetoric to get himself into office, and he's not unique in doing that. Every politician does it to an extent. But if he was so morbidly anti-Islam and so morbidly anti-Muslims, would he have made Saudi Arabia the birthplace of Islam, the first country of his overseas mission? Would he have sold $110 billion worth of military hardware to empower a regional power to manage global affairs, so that they don't end up repeating the same mistakes of the past and keep on invading, intervening in their affairs? So Saudi Arabia has been a win. Israel-Palestine is another one. Continuously, successive American governments, going right back to Truman and Eisenhower and what have you, through the two Bushes and Obama, have tried all sorts of things with a two-state solution and a one-state solution and a this and a that and a Camp David Accords and the Oslo Accords and the Taba Summit and the Beirut Summit. What have we got in the end? Israel withdrew from Gaza unilaterally in 2005. All they got was a bunch of rockets from the militant organization Hamas. So what Donald Trump has done is two things. He said, well, we're going to put some clarity into this issue and remove the ambiguity created by my predecessors. Recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, and Palestinians had been previously demanding a state first and seeking economic stability later. He's reversed the order. The Trump-Kushner plan says we're going to pump $50 billion into your economy and help you build first and then talk about statehood later. So the Israel-Palestine thing has been a refreshing drift away from everything his predecessor has tried. Third thing, Pakistan, a country that has received billions of dollars worth of foreign aid from the United States while saying, well, you know, we are the biggest victims of terrorism, this, that, blah, blah, blah. In the end, where is Osama bin Laden found? Living it up in a border bud, kilometers down the road from their military headquarters. Donald Trump says, no, you're not going to keep on doing that to us. And the critics were saying, oh, this is going to bring about an end to US-Pakistan relations. But Imran Khan was just sitting in the Oval Office last month, sipping tea with Donald Trump. Has it ruined their relations? No. So being a tough leader isn't always a bad thing. It eliminates ambiguity, and Donald Trump gets that. And again, I don't want to talk too much beyond my area of expertise, which is the Middle East, as correctly stated in the introduction. I don't want to be trespassing into Professor Flake's territory, but I will end with a final point. North Korea. Again, Donald Trump, by walking over the demilitarized zone as a symbolic gesture, having twice met the leader of the North Korean regime, I'm not going to stand here and pretend that he's solved all the problems as far as the Asia-Pacific is concerned, as far as our relations or the US relations with North Korea are concerned, but ask yourself whether he has not taken a refreshing change away from the approach of his predecessors, and I would argue he has. So, to recap, we're not here to have a general chinwag about anything and everything to do with Donald Trump. We're here to have a narrow and specific debate about how Donald Trump, as the leader of the most powerful country in the world, interacts with the world. Why? Because we're a part of that world. Has he left the world better off or worse off? I would argue, looking at his refreshing drift away in approaches towards Saudi Arabia, towards Pakistan, towards Israel-Palestine, he has eliminated ambiguity from the equation. He's provided strong leadership, and they respect that in the Middle East. They respect that. So we don't want to be like those critics of Donald Trump that first said that he would never be the Republican nominee until he actually became one. Then they said that he would never be the president until he became one. Now they're saying that he won't get a second term, and guess what? He will. I'll leave you on that thought. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Sherry. Lots to ponder, I think, over dinner there in your discussion. Whether Donald Trump has left the world in a better or worse state, I feel like that is up for debate over dinner. So thank you very much, for that different prism, as you put it. That was refreshing to hear that, because that's not what we see in the media, particularly here in Australia. And you did mention the way that media does shape, certain narratives, and that is an important thing to keep in mind. Okay, next up and our last speaker for this evening before we open up into Q&A is Michael Wood. And Michael's going to offer the perspective of having been in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade for 33 years, and he's recently been our Consul General to Chicago, so has a very strong, I guess, American context as well. So if you could please welcome Michael Wood. Thank you.
I'm going to take a somewhat different tack to the previous two speakers. So I'm not going to look at Donald Trump per se, but rather to see him as symptomatic as something else. But if we're going to understand what that thing is, and it's a very concerning issue that I want to put to you, then we really do need to understand exactly who Trump is and how he came to be where he is. So I'll start with a definition of Donald Trump. He's a demagogue. We don't need to debate this. He exploits prejudice and ignorance. And the most powerful explanator of his success in 2016 was the support he gained from those with low educational attainment. And he portrays himself as the enemy of the elites. And for once, speaking truthfully, he says that almost everybody in Washington is against him. And he shuts down reasoned debate with relentless cries of fake news. He's amoral. He lacks a moral compass. He has no feel for whether something is right or wrong. And it's not that he chooses to cross lines, he can't see them. So he appeared not to understand why most people were repulsed when he said before he became president that if his daughter, Ivanka, was not his daughter, he would probably date her. Now, there's no ambiguity here. That means have sex with her. He didn't understand the response he got from that. Now, he's a relentless liar because all successful propagandists know if you repeat a lie often enough, then your audience loses its factual grounding. And there are no limits on his lying. To this day, he claims that his father was born in Germany. He was, in fact, born in the Bronx. He is extraordinarily ignorant and foolish for someone in a position of such power. There are reasons why Gordon was distressed to discover that he was successful. He's famously unwilling, and a famously unwilling reader, knows little about history and therefore has no way to learn from it. He can't see that he's being played by the murderous dictators such as Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un, who he chooses to associate with. Now, Trump's flaws are highly distracting, but it's essential to remind ourselves that he is not a uniquely US phenomenon. So in his political class, he keeps company with demagogues like Orban in Hungary and Netanyahu in Israel and Turkey's Erdogan, Brazil's Bolsonaro, and Duterte of the Philippines. This is important because before asking what is beyond Trump, we have to have an idea about what actually delivered such an unqualified person to the presidency. There are many theories. You'll hear different ones from the panel tonight. But if your explanation cannot encompass the global drift towards the conservative right, towards chauvinism, xenophobia, populism and demagoguery, towards Brexit, separatism, and away from collaboration, then your theory is not a particularly powerful explanation of what is going on to us all in the world at the moment. There is almost certainly something going on at the global scale. Trump is simply symptomatic of that. So here's my best understanding of the forces underlying the global trend. So I invite you to understand everything that we are living through now as the result of the unsustainability of accelerating change for humans. So we have a very high tolerance of uncertainty and disruption, but we have our limits. The acceleration of change is leaving increasing numbers behind. The average human with the average education just can't see how their children are going to thrive in a world where they don't know if they're going to have a job for life, they don't know whether a computer or a robot or a foreigner is going to take that job from them, or where the tools of their job are constantly changing and leave them challenged at doing the things that they take great pride in doing, and that they should be good at, having done it for so long. So this presumably influences the less educated more negatively than those who have the intellectual background to handle such challenges more effectively. But it's my view that the anxiety over this acceleration of change probably underlies everything else. And I invite you to think of it as in terms of a bunch of people on a rather rickety but ever-accelerating roller coaster strapped in with some rather tenuous straps, yelling, "Stop! Make it go like it did before. Make it great again." So another factor which gains purchase when you're already anxious about change is inequality. Rising income and wealth inequality amazingly has not reduced Americans' belief in the American dream, even though endless studies show that you are more likely to break out of your economic and societal background if you live in allegedly socialist Sweden than if you do in the United States. But when you believe in the dream and you're not living the dream, your response is to say, well, no one else is going to get it. And it's an unfortunate negative response. It's all too human. If you don't get the pie, you want to make sure no one else is at the table. So you stop immigration. It's rational if your concern is economic. And you encourage the building of a wall. We could go into that. I'm not sure that building a wall is as evil as it's portrayed, but the reason why people support it is because they are anxious about the future. So in sum, change is leaving many behind and threatening to leave many more. Those who see themselves at risk or at risk of losing, as the losers or at risk of losing, are often the less educated. They're angrily reaching out to those who promise to champion their cause and set everything right again, set it back to where it was when it was predictable and manageable, without a master's degree, when no one is going to ask you to innovate yourself out of your own job. Now, the future, and this is really the short part, but if I'm forced to take a view, I'm going to take your money, Sherry. I expect Trump to buck tradition and to fail to get a second term. There's a pretty simple reason for this. I don't know if anybody's familiar with the website 538. This is the chart that plots Trump's approval rating since inauguration. And you'll see there's been pretty consistent since the very beginning. If you can't read it or interpret it, I'll just quickly explain that 54% of people polled disapprove of him, 41% approve. His net disapproval rating is therefore 13%, and it's been roughly the same since the first month of his inauguration. In the first month of his inauguration, you might just see right off there to the left-hand side, he had a net positive approval rating. That has not been the case since about February of 2017. We're looking at buyer's remorse. We saw that in the 2018 midterm elections. I just can't see, looking at that trajectory there, that is going to change in the lead up to the next election. Now, but the question is, further ahead, can anyone, including the progressive left, including them, can they do anything to slow down the roller coaster of change that I've described is behind everybody's reaching out for demagogues and the like? Will current young people manage change better than we have been managing? Will they be better equipped to recognise demagogues than we have, apparently? Or will they be more principled and not vote for them when we do recognise them? So I don't have any answers to this, but history is not particularly encouraging. Now, there is a question about whether Trump matters. So if I believe that Trump won't get a second term, can he really do much harm, or at least harm that can't easily be reversed? So I'm afraid I'm a pessimist on behalf of the US and for Australia as an ally. First, I'm going to argue uncontroversially, I hope, that we've enjoyed the benefits of Pax Americana for so long because the US offers not just hard power, but soft power. And I'm going to define soft power here as the capacity to lead, to get others to join you, and to do what you want them to do without expending blood and treasure. And how do you acquire soft power? So it's the same way that you do when you make friends. You behave in particular ways and do certain things that are attractive to your friends. But that has to be underpinned by reliability, predictability, consistency. Those are the friends that we trust, and these qualities are only acquired over time. So you don't have friends or soft power or the ability to lead until you've demonstrated those qualities over a long enough period of time to engender trust and belief in your friends. So this is how I see soft power. Let's imagine it takes all day to build this sandcastle. Probably with large numbers of people, you need people to do the building, and you need people to bring the sand, and you need people to bring the water to mix with the sand. You need people to stop the waves from coming in by building walls, and you need people to stop your kids and dogs from wrecking it. There are reasons to believe that in 3 years, Trump is going to do what you fear somebody is going to do to your sandcastle. It takes you all day to build it and how many seconds to destroy it. It's soft power is not something you can buy from Raytheon or Boeing. Soft power takes the time that I've described. So Trump has stomped all over US soft power, and by that I mean that it is no longer the case that the US can be described as reliable. It is no longer predictable. It is no longer consistent, not in the ways that we've come to recognize of the US over the last few decades. And the truth is that you're no longer reliable the moment you are unreliable. And it takes as long as it takes for memories to fade to earn back the trust and belief that your friends need to have in you. So the destructive power of Trump also, as others have said before, it doesn't just come from Trump himself. It comes from one of the great political institutions on the planet, the Republican Party, which has been silent, enabling Trump throughout the last 3 years. We have the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who appears to be cut from the same scruple-free cloth that Trump is. And we've seen after 3 years that Trump's base, that sort of the green line that we saw before, that's been pretty consistently strong since about February 2017. So the US owns this man. Now, it would be a triumph of thinking, of wishful thinking, in my view, to believe that the real US is somehow just taking a break behind this facade of clownish demagoguery. So how has Trump undermined US leadership? I'm grateful to Gordon for having spelt this out. I'm not going to repeat that, but except to say that Trump has threatened to pull the US out of the World Trade Organization, threatened to pull it out of NAFTA, pulled it out of the Paris Accord, pulled it out of negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's pulled it out of the Iran nuclear deal. The truth is that the US signature on an agreement now is only as good as the day it was signed. We don't know whether Trump will honor it tomorrow. Now, the question then is, where are we now? The US has become the country that unpicks international cooperation. The US has become the country that no longer acts in the collective global interest. The US signature on an agreement is now maybe only good on the day it was signed, as I said. The US is turning inwards and eschewing leadership, and it's not just Trump. Half of the US political class has stood back in silence, enabling his worst instincts and his foolishness. And in the 3 years that he's been in power, the US soft power has been heavily eroded, as we've discussed. Its allies, like Australia, are weakened accordingly. Now, remember, on my analysis, it might get better in the short term. I'm going to be 30 seconds after the next election. But in the long run, accelerating change, notably in the form of artificial intelligence and automation, is not going to stop. It will continue to create large classes in society who are unable to cope. Those people will again lurch towards demagogues who offer false hope of stability and stasis, if not reversion to the comfort of the past. Not until the rate of societal change slows, or until we get better straps on our roller coaster, can we get back to more reliable patterns of principled governance globally. And I want to leave you with a question. What do you imagine might cause the rate of change that I've described to decelerate? Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Michael. Good to have, I guess, some insights or some thinking about the psychology of people in the United States and people who are voting for Trump. And you have boldly put out there that we are looking at beyond Trump. So it's good to have a showdown between you and Sherry, and interested to see what people here in the audience think as well and what questions you want to ask. Just in terms of Q&A etiquette, if I could just ask if you could please introduce yourself briefly and also nominate who you'd like your question to go to on our panel this evening. And if I can ask you also to please keep seated, because we do have the camera rolling at the back, and if we're having people standing up, it could interfere with the vision. So we do have our Secretary Molly, who's going to be handing the microphone around. So if I can just have a show for anybody who might have the first question. Any hands up? Where's one here, Mark? While Mark is getting the microphone, I might just turn over to our own Mr. President here, John Goodlad, to ask the first question of our panel this evening.
Well, thanks very much. I wonder if certainly a number of insights there, and most particularly the one about the prism through which we view President Trump and this part of the world in particular. So, Gordon, as a North Korea specialist, what prism should we see this through? Is this, you know, so there was an allusion to friendship with strong men, which certainly puts out the leader of Canada, but seems to me that President Trump will play ball with Putin, with Xi Jinping, with the leader of North Korea, etc. But then the substance of that relationship tends to get murky. How do we conceptualise what's going on here? And all speakers will have a view on it, I'm sure.
So very specifically, the term which we've used for a long time, the leader of the free world, is generally applied to the president of the United States because of the role the United States has played, particularly post-World War II, in building the systems, standards, norms, institutions, laws that created, you know, that rules-based order. That's why the U.S. is called the leader of the free world, and presumably the leader of the U.S. is the leader of the free world in that regard. In this case, to be honest, I mean, it's very difficult to make that case about President Trump as an individual. His own personal proclivities lean much more towards the authoritarian. And again, just this week alone, we saw that on stark display in the G7 meetings, where his affinity for Vladimir Putin and his affinity for Kim Jong-un were openly declared, and his difficulty in dealing with democratically elected leaders was also openly displayed. And so people say he's no longer the leader of the free world, he's gone to the other side. That's a little bit overstated, particularly if you talk about where the U.S. is, because the U.S. as a system has yet to go that direction. If you'll forgive me, let me just address North Korea. And again, I actually appreciate the difficult task that Sherry had and his ability to kind of define the problem down to these very few scenarios that might possibly render a positive outcome. Because if you look at broadly the alliance system, the international order, the UN, anything more broader than that, again, there has been this kind of broad kind of destructive swath that has taken place in the last 2.5 years. If you're a Saudi, you definitely like President Trump. I'm not so sure that's more broadly perceived in the rest of the region. If you're a supporter of Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, I think you like President Trump. If you're a Jew more broadly, internationally, if you're an American Jew, you know, and he's basically said any American Jew that votes for a Democrat is disloyal, you know, those are really, really alarming terms, right? So I'm not so sure he's a friend of Israel, per se, as much as he's a friend of Benjamin Netanyahu and he's a friend of the glowing orb and the Saudi, you know, kingship. And again, I don't know that that I would attribute to a broader strategy as much as it's personal interest. But the one area I do want to touch is North Korea. Because again, looking at this from an Australian national interest perspective, to be very blunt, Australia is technologically, scientifically, diplomatically, in every way more advanced than North Korea. And yet Australia has made a decision not to develop nuclear weapons, not to develop long-range missiles. Because it relies, one, on an alliance relationship with the United States, but two, on that international liberal system, the rules-based order when it comes to security. We rely on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. We rely upon the International Atomic Energy Agency and their safeguards agreement, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the chemical, you know, the missile technology control regimes. All of those things that are the rules-based order when it comes to security, and all of those things which have been shredded by North Korea. So this is why Australia has been so outspoken, not just now, not under the Trump administration, but for the last several decades, about North Korean actions which directly impact Australia's national security strategy, which directly undermine the rules-based order on which we depend. Right? And so when you have a president like Trump, for want of vanity or glory, who's willing to have, you know, a summit, and again, I did everything I could to keep an open mind in Singapore, in all the pageantry of Singapore, and then in Hanoi, and then across the thing, where in no case North Korea ever committed to denuclearize. In fact, those of us who have been following this issue with, again, probably too much focus over the last 20 years, know that when North Koreans say that they commit to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they explicitly mean that they will, as a peer power of the United States, be willing one day in the future to discuss mutual disarmament. But denuclearization of the peninsula means end of the alliance with South Korea, removal of U.S. troops, and abandonment of the nuclear umbrella of extended deterrence, by which the United States extends its nuclear capabilities to support allies like Japan, South Korea, and Australia. They're explicit about that. There's no ambiguity about that. There's no other president in the world who would have agreed to a statement that says we agree to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Only President Trump, against the advice of his own team. And now we've seen in a year and a half later that every time his own team, his own intelligence community, military, continues to leak information that North Korea continues to test both their nuclear program, military program, and they're really, really worried about it. All you need is a nice letter from Kim Jong-un that says, you are so great. Wasn't it great when we were there together? I love you. And the president's fine with it, right? So is that in Australia's national interest? You know, again, I appreciate the notion of refreshing, but to me, yeah, I'm happy that we're not at war. But again, remember, you know, Kim Beazley and I were here together. We co-authored a piece for Australian Foreign Affairs in January of 2018, where it was very subtly titled "Prepare for War." You know, because we're so concerned we're at the cusp of war, because we were then talking about Little Rocket Man, and we were talking about fire and fury such as the world has never known. Jaw-jaw is better than war-war, and yes, you're right, that's refreshing. But if you're looking at it from an Australian national security perspective and the rules-based order, it's been a disaster.
Okay, we'll go across to Mark.
Okay, my question. This is also for Gordon, I'm afraid, but the other members of the panel might want to comment on it. And it's particularly in light of what some of Michael's observations about the United States being an unreliable ally. And the question is about our potential cooperation in patrolling the Straits of Hormuz and making sure Iran doesn't behave badly. Now, some of us with longer memories can remember the commitment to Vietnam, the appalling apocalypse in Iraq. We've seen this movie before, haven't we? That our unswerving loyalty to the United States, no matter what, an obligation, it seems, to participate in what looks like being another misguided adventure. So if you're giving advice to the Australian government, Gordon, what are you going to tell them to do, to go along with it or not?
Australia has been an unswervingly loyal ally to the United States, and it's done so partly out of a belief that that loyalty is necessary to assure U.S. support for Australia. Ironically, that perception is quite different depending on which region of the world you're looking at. If you're looking at the Middle East, it's very difficult to make a strong case for why Australia should be involved in very specific activities other than the relationship with the United States. The contrast is in our region here, in the Indo-Pacific, you know, Australia actually plays a much more important leadership role and actually has probably more influence on the United States than vice versa, particularly in Southeast Asia, in terms of how the region is framed and understood, and we are much more proactively in lobbying the United States than the other way around. So understandably then, in that context, I tend to think that Australia should be much more focused on, with limited resources, on this region rather than the Middle East. Now, I do understand the political calculations involved here. You know, the Straits of Hormuz are particularly challenging because the crisis was precipitated by a United States decision to withdraw from the agreement with Iran against the opposition of its allies involved in that process. And so, yes, we have a problem, and yes, Australia has an inherent national interest in sea lanes of communication in the Straits of Hormuz and elsewhere. But you know, my own preference and predilection would have been to try to pit the U.S. Pacific Command, or now the Indo-Pacific Command, against the Central Command and say, we need our forces and we're much better served here in the Indo-Pacific than there. Why don't you talk to European allies instead? Unfortunately, again, I understand it. It's difficult to say this is a wrong decision. It's a relatively minor contribution by Australia. And so, I wouldn't go to say, this is horrible, this is the end of the world, Australia never should have done this. In the context of what has happened in terms of ship seizures, as what's happened in terms of the British involvement too, you know, again, I don't think this is the worst decision ever made. My preference or my predilection would be to lean back towards the region. But again, this is really more Sherry's direct area, so maybe Sherry should comment on that.
Look, I can. our engagement with the Middle East is born out of necessity. And you know, as the old saying goes, that politics does not leave you with a choice between a good option and a bad option. Often it's a choice. Too often it's a choice between a bad option and a worse option. So if we were to isolate ourselves from US adventures in the Middle East, which again, I would argue, have for the most part been unavoidable up until present point in time, that can itself set off a sequence of events which would eventually plunge us into some sort of a conflict in a roundabout way anyway. So if there's going to be a war, I would rather us stand with our allies, because we do have the ANZUS Treaty. We have had it since the end of World War II. They've had our back and we have theirs. I mean, obviously, we're the weaker of the two allies, as Gordon even acknowledged. We have deliberately avoided becoming a nuclear power on the assumption that they've got our backs, and I would argue that they probably do. We've got 2,000 American troops stationed up at Darwin. It might be inadequate in terms of pure numbers, but from a posturing point of view, they're there. And if the US decides that it wants to participate in the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, the whatever, now we don't always get involved in every single American war. Let's just be clear about that, because where was our involvement in all of the US, the many US adventures in Latin American countries during the peak period of the Cold War? We didn't go into Panama, for example, but the Middle East is a slightly different basket case and has been, you know, going back to the colonial history with World War I and World War II. Again, Gordon mentioned the Strait of Hormuz. There's been some activity in the last couple of weeks. If Donald Trump had been, and I think it's important to acknowledge, if Donald Trump had been half the maniac that Hillary Clinton made him out to be during the course of the presidential debates, remember she used to say that this is not a bloke we can trust with a nuclear codes. If he had been half the person she said he was, he would have bombed the Iranians after what happened just several weeks ago. So I think he has got the temperament to be a good leader. I think he has got the temperament to be the refreshing change that I spoke about before, whether it be with North Korea or with the broader Middle East. And just on the Iran deal too, look, I'll be clear again about this issue. There, in principle, there is nothing wrong with a country anywhere in the world having nuclear weapons. I mean, there's about 8 or so of them, according to Wikipedia, that have it officially. The number gets slightly higher if you go unofficial. Some countries haven't declared it. There's a country right next to Iran that has nuclear weapons. It's called Pakistan. Why aren't we bombing them? Why aren't we talking about putting sanctions on them? Why is Pakistan allowed to have a nuclear weapon but not Iran? That's a question we should all be able to answer as panelists and as members of the audience. The short answer is because of the what's come out of the mouths of successive Iranian leaders. Iran used to be a fairly secular and fairly pro-Western, and I say that with some reservation, but reasonably pro-Western country under the Shah until 1979. Then the Shiite Islamic Revolution happened, and the rest is history. Since then, they have actively demonized the world's only Jewish state, which is around the corner from Israel. Ahmadinejad, their last leader, is on the record saying that Israel won't even last 25 years. So, you know, people will say, oh, look, that's just posturing. Oh, it's all empty talk. Maybe it is. I don't dispute that. But you're still saying it. And if I'm looking at you from the perspective of somebody who has to make advice on what foreign policy we should make, I can only judge you by what you put on the record. If you have no hostile intentions towards a country around the corner, why would you come out and say make all these claims? What, to appease the aggrieved public in your country? Well, whatever. Everything is going to have consequences. So Pakistan has nuclear weapons, and the West doesn't intervene. They don't do anything about it. Ever thought about that point before? It's right next door to Iran. Nobody ever says a single damn thing about Pakistan. But we are cautious about Iran having nuclear weapons. So that's kind of how I see it. And I think Trump at the moment, again, he's not perfect. Nobody's perfect. But is he better than his predecessors? I would say he is.
I might just, if I can just... Can I take a quick opportunity to respond? I think Sherry's outlined the nuances here very well, though I would say that it does... The whole Iranian issue is a confection of the US pulling out of the deal that President Obama put in place. And there is a relentless effort by the good President Trump to demolish the legacy of President Obama. It almost doesn't matter what he did. So we have to bear that in mind, you know, what his motives might be. I think the world was much safer for the Iranian nuclear deal than it is without. And I think also... Sorry?
Not for the Syrians under Obama.
So I'll get to that later if you want to ask a question. You know, there are so many complexities, but ultimately I think Australia has to think very hard about how it responds to any sort of invitation to join the US action here. And there's a tendency to feel that if the United States president requests something, that is the United States asking Australia to act, and that we have... no choice morally or in alliance terms but to agree. And I think that's wrong. And I think the reason why is when you look at the United States today, it's an incredibly divided country. You're looking at about half the country that supports Trump, and you're looking at about half the country that would like to lock him up. So when we do whatever President Trump asks us to do, we are alienating the other half of the country. So we have to be very thoughtful about how we respond to the President of the United States.
Thanks, Michael. We just have the gentleman down. Yep. Thanks, Molly. You could just quickly introduce yourself.
Thank you. Brendan Augustine, member of the AIIA, currently working in corporate Australia, but previously a DFAT official. Speaking in my personal capacity, of course, here. I guess the question, and Gordon in his last intervention talked about it, and I think this is a point really worth reflecting on, is in, you know, what's in Australia's national interests. I see in the landscape a lot of people who support Trump saying, oh, he's a good disruptor, he's refreshing, it's a change, is changing, he's shaking up the international system. But let's first ask the question, how has the international system benefited Australia post-Second World War, and particularly in the last 28 years of uninterrupted economic growth, whatever you want to dispute the GDP figures and how it's calculated. So my proposition is that the international system, based on rules and norms that Gordon talked about so eloquently, has benefited Australia tremendously. In our own lives, in our own personal lives, what have we seen in the last 30, 40 years? Okay, from our own perspective here in WA, what have we seen? I arrived in WA as an immigrant in 1986. It's a very different place today. The markets that we have been able to grow in my industry, in the resource industry, very different. So can we sit here and hand on heart say the world was broken before Donald Trump appeared on the world to refresh the international system? I would argue no. I think there's obviously has been problems with the international political and economic system, but in the main, it has worked to Australia's national interests. And working within it in a conventional, sometimes with many disruptions, sometimes managing difficult conflicts and emergence of new powers, that requires a lot of delicate maneuvering and changes. But my thesis is it has worked for Australia, and we are here to, I think, first and foremost, is to look at Australia's interest, the open trading system, the emergence of China, the emergence of Southeast Asia. That has impacted on us personally here in this room, those who are Australians and those who live here. So we are saying that Trump has made a paradigm shift in the international system, I'll be worried. So I'm interested to say, has Trump made a paradigm shift in the international system? Are we going to have a system that allows the US to be some sort of a guarantee, or at least evolve into a newer form of a guarantee that has allowed us this unmitigated success in Australia?
So the question is around a paradigm shift. So who would like to respond first here on our panel? Gordon?
I can be quick in one area where I hopefully slightly disagree with Michael on this front. I think, first off, I'm not willing to cede the notion that Trump is just a symptom, not a cause. Yes, there were issues. Yes, democracies are struggling with new ways of information flows. Yes, there's general malaise. Yes, there has been, shifting Gini coefficients and you have concentration of wealth. Those are all real serious problems, right? But the United States had 9 years, almost 9 years, 8.5 years of unbroken economic growth, albeit not fast enough in the U.S. Things were getting pretty good at the end of 2016, and that has continued since then, where things are going pretty good right now. I think individuals make a difference, right? So in other words, you had to have an individual who was willing to trash the system, who was willing to crash it. So you wouldn't have Brexit without those, and I would argue, disingenuous individuals. I'm not talking about the UKIP guys, the real crazy ones. I'm talking about the disingenuous people in the Conservative Party, the Tories, who are willing to ride that to destruction. And you wouldn't have in the United States without individuals who are willing to ride that to destruction. Now, why do I mention it in the context of the paradigm shift? I hope we don't have this Land Council. Michael's logic is correct. I'm just clinging onto some hope that there is an opportunity for us to have a bit of a snapback, a pendulum swing. And that requires not a narrow Democratic victory. That requires a broad, sweeping repudiation of Trump and Trumpism. If we had the same results as we saw in 2018, I remember the day after the midterm elections in 2018, I was so depressed because the marquee people hadn't won their elections, and it just seemed like that massive blue wave hadn't materialized until the votes came in. And it did materialize. There were 9 million more votes cast for Democratic candidates than Republican candidates. It was a massive shift. And again, in Australia, that would be a historic two-party swing, and we just kind of went on beyond it. If we have something akin to 2018, that type of a broad-based repudiation of Trump, I hope that there can be something salvaged in terms of the process and we're not facing a paradigm shift. However, if Donald Trump wins re-election, every ally, every other part in the room that's just hoping against hope that the U.S. has just got a really bad case right now, and they will return to a leadership role, leadership of the free world, they will give up hope, right? What we can handle for 4 years, we cannot handle for 8 years. Then I think what you'll find is just a broad and sweeping shift of the entire international system. So.
Okay, I'm going to move to Max Devitri now.
Thank you. Max Devitri, African Geopolitics. I'd like to thank Michael for introducing the fact that Trump had pulled out of a number of international agreements, but I like my question is more towards Gordon, who's described Trump as a destructive warth and trashing the system. Now, my thing is that, in fact, Trump is only a continuation of an American world power trying to keep its position. Way back in 1949, the United States refused to sign the Declaration of Duties of Obligations of States, which pointed out that each country had its own right to live under its own political system. They haven't signed the Law of the Sea. Although they've pushed countries to go into encourage countries to go into the ICC, the International Criminal Court, they haven't joined. The International Court of Justice, they've very much put sticks in its wheels. The World Trade Organization, they've been blocking by stopping the nomination of judges in one of its main courts. Now, is Trump just an aberration then and a continuation of the American system and its fear of losing its hegemonic position? And in reality, we're here in Australia. We are partners in commercial partners with China, and we have a partnership for security with the United States. Where should we stand? How should we proceed forward? That's
Thank
my
you,
question.
Max. Okay, we'll just bring that back to the panel now to answer.
I would grant everything you said in terms of the broad swath of history, and at the same time stand back and be amazed that a country that came out of World War II with such unrivaled supremacy still went about building international institutions which inherently transferred its power to the system. So you're absolutely correct about the International Criminal Court, the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. There are all these issues, and there's domestic political explanations for the United States. But as a whole, if you look at the post-World War II liberal rules-based global order international system, you have to be amazed at what the United States did, right? So for all the problems, the balance of it, it's remarkable, both economically and the American role. Again, part of this was the Cold War, but in rebuilding former adversaries, in rebuilding Germany, in rebuilding Europe, in rebuilding Japan, in building the rules of the road. So again, of course, every country has hypocrisies. Every country has strengths and weaknesses. But in general, that system that I think Brendan rightly points out has served Australia so well, and I would add, has served China so extremely well, and the rest of the region so extremely well. That's what I'm worried about, right? That's where I do see. Now, people will say, well, both Clinton and Trump were opposed to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The day the U.S. pulled out of the TPP was again, a really black-letter day from my point of view. And I would argue that the role of Australia and Japan in resurrecting the TPP in the last year and a half is one of the most underreported, miraculous things I've ever seen, done specifically holding the door open for the United States to come back to its senses, to come back in the system. Because without the U.S., without the 800-pound gorilla, these rules don't really matter much, right? Mm-hmm. So again, I fully agree with what you're saying, but the alternative is much, much worse. And I, from my perception, 25 years in Washington, D.C., before moving here 6 years ago, do see a sharp turn. And again, it's not just against international organizations. It's against anything multilateral, period. It's against alliances. That basic understanding, it is a shift towards a highly transactional approach to world power and politics. And we haven't expected that from the United States. We all have expected the United States to be better than that. And the good news is, again, there are some on the Democratic side whose positions on trade I find deeply, deeply concerning. You know, candidly, Bernie Sanders and even Elizabeth Warren are probably closer to Trump, you know, than they are to where I would like them to be on this thing, right? But the bulk of them, and again, those polls that I point out, show me that there is some hope that Americans, again, I'll throw out one more poll I didn't put out in my presentation. The Chicago Council on Global Affairs did a poll about American support for NATO. This is at a time when Trump was railing against it, right? 78% approval rating, the highest ever in history, right? So my sense is the Americans as a whole want to be perceived as the good guys. We don't want to be the bad guys. We want to be the good guys in that process. Now, I can't answer the China-U.S. question. Again, that's debated every single day in Australia and on TVs. But in the end, in terms of the Trump approach to this issue, there's no question that the rise of China has been the fundamental challenge of the last 5 years, maybe the last 10 years, and that the Trump administration, to their credit, have addressed the problem. But my belief is any U.S. administration would have to address it because of fundamental changes within China, right? It's not like we woke up one day and decided we're threatened by China, we're going to, you know, resist them. We woke up one day and said Xi Jinping's China has reversed the Deng Xiaoping consensus and they're fundamentally playing a different game. And so at this point, I don't think opposition to China, or rather concern about the role that China is playing, is a particularly partisan issue. I'm just concerned that what should have been a coordinated with allies and with international organizations and institutions and the rules-based order approach has become this flailing effort to get soybeans purchased, right? So again, it's malevolence tempered by incompetence, but not in trade. So.
Okay, any closing comments from Sherry or Michael, particularly on this last bit about China? No?
For the evening or on that question?
For the evening, this is the last question, and then we're going to wrap things up, and this sort of discussion can continue over dinner, I'm sure.
Sure. I might just take the opportunity to say, just following on from that question and Gordon's comments, that I really do believe that it's a mistake to see Trump as sui generis. When he's gone, he will almost certainly be replaced by somebody much better. But half of the country is in a state of deep anxiety and distress, and that's not going to change. So you'll see, I think in this next election, you'll see a big change for the better, and some of those breadcrumbs might still be there, Gordon, that we can, follow back. But I think it will be a long time before the US has anything like the standing that it always had throughout my life so far to date. And Australia is going to have to find a different way of thinking about itself, or it's going to find that it's aligned with a country whose stocks have dropped everywhere.
Sherry, you're Donald Trump's advisor coming into this next election. What advice are you going to give him?
I'd be getting him to advise our Prime Minister on how to run this country, actually. Thank you again, John, and to the Institute for hosting this discussion. I'll leave you on the following thought. There was a lot we mentioned tonight, especially one of the earlier questioners about a paradigm shift. I personally hate to use these terms, but it is important to discuss it. There is some sort of a paradigm shift happening in the world, but rather than seeing Donald Trump as a force that's propelling it or causing it, I would say that he is more of a response to a paradigm shift that had already begun happening decades ago. Let's not forget that only a century or so ago, the world map looked very different from the way it looks today. Go back to 1919, exactly 100 years ago. There was no such thing as countries, you had empires. And I've often made this point. Empires were very large. They were multi-religious, multi-ethnic, multilinguistic. And there's a reason why empires collapsed. The Ottoman Empire, which was Turkish, was ruling over a people that spoke Arabic in the Middle East, for the most part. It's gone, right? The British Empire ruled a very, very vast amount of territory, English-speaking, predominantly secular Christian type of a world order, was ruling over a billion people in the Indian subcontinent who had their own religions, their own languages, and so on and so forth. The same applies to every other empire, even if we look at the Soviet Empire, which was the last to collapse only about 30-something years ago. Why did empires collapse? Empires collapsed because of a funny little thing called nationalism, because people like to stick with those that they consider part of their cultural grouping, okay? What mass immigration into the Western world has done in the last few decades is it's undone nationalism. It's literally recreated the circumstances that a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, multi-linguistic empires had to deal with. And Europe is a classic example. And I was just in Europe last month, specifically researching this particular issue, talking to different academics and think tanks. And the sense that I got was there are a lot of people that used to be very pro, let's bring everyone in, no problems, we can all get along, 30-odd years ago, but looking at very high unemployment rates among certain communities, also proclivity towards violent extremism in certain communities, has made these people reconsider things. And Donald Trump, to bring the conversation back to the focal point of tonight, has tapped into that space. Now, you see, if you or I tried to start a movement in this country against, let's say, Hindu people or Sikh people, I can guarantee you you're not going to get a single vote, because Australians are not fundamentally racist against anybody. But there are anti-Muslim political parties and they do get a lot of votes. So what's going on there? You have to think critically about all of this. Now, I'm not suggesting here that all Muslims or most Muslims hold radical views, but many people in those communities do tend to hold radical views. Not all, but many do. And all it takes for someone to cause carnage is one person. This has been happening on a very large scale for a very long time. A country called Israel in the Middle East has faced it since before its birth. On September 11, the world awakened to the realization that the Islamist agenda has to be defeated. Donald Trump comes into the picture and he says, okay, well, we're going to start shaking things up a little bit. He was talking tough on certain communities and people responded. If you were to go back and substitute his anti-Muslim rhetoric with anti-Native Indian rhetoric or whatever else, or somebody who's not perceived as a threat by large numbers of Americans, he wouldn't have been elected. So these issues cannot be avoided. If there is a paradigm shift, Trump's not the one causing it. The paradigm shift had started long before. He's just a response to it. Maybe a dangerous one for some people's liking. I'll even agree with that. But what we need to do in the Western world is to rethink the balance between national pride and a kind of an immigration policy that is based on integration and proportionality. Proportionality, that's and balance. That's probably where I'll leave you.
Balance is a good way to leave it. Thanks very much.